Good evening. We're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming. My name is Rachel Belanti, and I am the Assistant Executive Officer of the California Water Commission. We are thrilled to be out here in Davis tonight and share information with you about our water storage investment program, but more importantly, get your feedback and your input on the program. This meeting is a part of our second of series of public meetings. We were in Napa on Monday, and we're going to be in Bakersfield in August for this round, and then we'll have another set of public meetings in October. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the elected officials who are here, Brett Lee from the Davis City Council, and we also have representatives from Assemblymember Bill Dodd, Assemblymember Kevin McCarty, and Congressman John Garamendi. I'd also like to thank Commission staff for all the work that they put into having this meeting. And Councilmember Brett Lee is going to say a few words. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. So this will be brief. Just on behalf of the City of Davis, I just want to thank the California Water Commission for, in general, hosting a meeting that the public's able to attend and learn more about the program. And then also specifically for the City of Davis to welcome them to our community. It's interesting, and again, I'll keep this brief, and I will, so don't worry. It's interesting that perhaps there is a silver lining to the drought. And I think that silver lining is perhaps the fact that as Californians, we've discovered that we can treat water as a precious resource, and that also we understand that we have to make some investments in our public infrastructure. And those types of investments in our infrastructure will last, you know, long into the future. Hope their drought is short-lived. Like presumably all of you, we're all hoping that the El Nino that there's forecast for next year will bring a plentiful, moderate rain. But anyway, as I say, perhaps the silver lining to the current drought that we're in is that we've, you know, really stepped up, and this commission is going to be describing ways in which we can invest several billion dollars into infrastructure, which will benefit all of California. I'm hopeful that they will learn a lot from the public outreach, and they'll have a wise and sensible investment policy for us. As a person born in California, you know, water has always been somewhat of an issue, but I think we're really taking it to a whole another level at this point. So with those brief comments, I'd like to say thank you very much for picking our city as one of the cities where you're holding a public meeting, and I wish you well in your endeavors. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Lee. We really appreciate you being here, and like I said, we're happy to be in Davis. I did just want to mention that a member of our commission, Armando Quintero, is on his way. He's driving in from Marin and is stuck in traffic, so he apologizes for being late and will be here very soon. And I'm going to hand it over to Juliana Burkhoff. She's with the Center for Collaborative Policy, and she is our facilitator for this evening.
So the agenda for today is to try and go over some information for you all and then solicit input. The most important thing of going around the state is to find out what your priorities are, what your concerns are, and what information you need. This, as Rachel said, this is the second set of public information sessions, and there'll be a third set in October. So it's really important to hear questions and concerns and input from you all. So we'll start hearing a little bit about the program and the overview. And Jenny Marr from the California Water Commission, who's the project staff for this, will talk about that. Then we'll have a little bit of questions and comments for her at that point about why are you investing in that way, what's the timeline, what do you need to pay attention to. Then we'll turn to Scott Cantrell from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We'll talk a little bit about what are the ecosystem priorities and how are those calculated and how will those feed into the investment program. Have a chance to ask Scott questions, and then we'll turn to Gail Link from the State Water Resources Control Board and talk about what the water quality priorities are and how that feeds into the investment program. And then we'll have a chance to ask her questions and then turn it open to questions and comments from all of you. Hopefully that we can get out of here by 8, but if we're still asking a lot of questions, we'll stay later because it's important to finish with all your questions. So I'll try to move you along and make sure that we hear from each one of you. So if you want to get in the queue, all you need to do is sort of catch my eye and I'll get you into the queue, but I'll sort of move left to right, row by row, to make sure that all of you have a chance to ask a question. So if that seems okay with people, and just to let you know, this is being videotaped from each set. The commission videotapes one of the public meetings so that people who aren't able to get to a meeting can watch it on the web. So that's what the staff in the back is there for. So we'll turn then to the first presentation from Jenny Marr, who will go over a little bit about the program.
Good evening. I'd like to thank everyone for being here, and thank everyone who's joining us on webcast, a virtual thank you. And I'm going to spend about 20 minutes just giving an overview of the Water Storage Investment Program and what we're working on. I'm also going to provide a little bit of background on Proposition 1, just because we weren't here in Davis during our first round of public meetings. That first round of public meetings really focused on describing Prop 1 and the requirements of Prop 1, because I know back in October of last year, I was busy working on flood programs and Prop 1. I knew it was out there. I knew a little bit it was about storage, but I hadn't read it. It wasn't really on my radar. And I remember watching, you know, our local news station here and listening that a vote for Prop 1 was voting for Sites Reservoir and Temperance Flat. And then once I started on this program and I read the legislation, I go, there's a lot of misinformation out there. That's not what this proposition says at all. And so our first series of public meetings is really about myth-busting and trying to correct some of the misinformation that's out there. So I'm going to sprinkle in some of the requirements of Prop 1 in my presentation, but I really wanted to focus on answering these three questions. What are the project eligibility criteria? What will the process be for reviewing and selecting projects? And what is the schedule for project selection? So hopefully, when you all leave today, you can at least answer those questions. So just a little bit on Prop 1, a little bit of introduction on why we're here. So this is an excerpt from Proposition 1, Chapter 8, the chapter that focuses on the water storage program, that appropriates $2.7 billion to the California Water Commission for the public benefits associated with water storage projects. And these water storage projects must improve the operation of the state water system, which the commission has globally defined as any water system in the state, are cost effective, and projects must provide a net improvement in ecosystem and water quality conditions. So a net improvement, we've got to look at balancing the benefits of projects versus the impacts of projects to ensure that we get a net improvement in our water system. So what are the eligible water storage projects? Oops, excuse me, the public benefits. I got ahead of myself. The public benefits of storage, as defined by the proposition, are ecosystem improvements, water quality improvements, flood control benefits, emergency response, and recreation. And we recognize that there are other benefits of storage. There's the water supply benefit aspect for municipal and urban uses. There's water supply aspect for ag uses. There's hydropower. There's other benefits. But for the purposes of Proposition 1 and what the money was allocated to the commission to fund were these five categories of public benefits. Eligible storage projects. Again, this proposition chapter focuses on water storage projects. And those have been defined in statute as the surface storage projects identified in the CalFed Record of Decision, groundwater storage projects, groundwater contamination prevention and remediation projects. And again, those projects have to provide storage benefits. It has to have a storage nexus. Conjunctive use projects, reservoir reop, and local and regional surface storage projects. One thing that is extremely important to note for anyone out there that plans on applying for Proposition 1 Water Storage Investment Program funding. In the statute, Section 79752, so you can find it in the statute, requires that projects funded must provide measurable improvement to the Delta ecosystem or to tributaries to the Delta. So this is a project eligibility requirement. Any project that comes in has to provide these measurable improvements. And we've defined tributaries to the Delta to include the Sacramento and San Joaquin River hydrologic regions and the Susan Marsh. So how are we going to do this? The statute tells the commission to do to develop a competitive process. And so we've developed this competitive process through the Water Storage Investment Program. Further, the statute tells the commission to rank potential projects based on the expected return for investment. Statute defines expected return for investment to be the magnitude of public benefits provided. So those five categories of public benefits are the main criteria with which the commission will be evaluating projects. We've got a list of about 50 criteria that they'll look at in total, but one of the most important that's identified in statute is the magnitude of public benefit. So an overview of our program. Our program's been developed to implement the requirements of Proposition 1. It also supports the Governor's Water Action Plan that was released last year. And it directly supports a goal in that plan of expanding water storage in California. The program is being implemented consistent with a Goals, Objectives, and Principles document that the Commission adopted at their last meeting. So those of you that attended the July meeting, you saw that the Commission adopted this plan. This plan's available on the Commission's website. And one of the main resolutions of this program is the adoption of regulations by December 15th, 2016. The regulations have to include how benefits will be quantified, how public benefits will be managed, and it'll also include the priorities of Department of Fish and Wildlife and the State Water Board. The date December 15th, 2016 is important for several reasons. Not only is that the date the commission has to adopt regulations, but it's also the first day the commission can spend money on projects. So one of the questions we received in our first round of public meetings was, how come we're not getting money out the door? We're in the middle of the drought. It's really important to build storage. Why are we sitting on this money? Well, the legislature thought to give the commission some time to develop a fair, equitable program and have a lot of opportunity for public outreach and get public comment before this $2.7 billion is spent. So in statute, it was written the commission cannot fund projects until after December 15th, 2016. So this is a little hard to see because it's bright in here, but everyone has a handout of this schedule in their packets, and it's our timeline for project planning. It shows the major activities this year, 2016 and 2017. So you'll notice in our schedule that this year we're really focused on developing these draft regulations and conducting as much early outreach as possible. Again, this is our second series of public meetings. We'll do a third series in October. All of the commission meetings are public. All of our stakeholder advisory committee meetings are public. And we're really trying to get out there and get as much feedback on this program as possible. So the star at the end of 2015 is when the commission will adopt draft regulations for the program. So when the commission adopts draft regulation, that starts the formal rulemaking process. And the formal rulemaking process is what you see in 2016, where the commission will hold public meetings and public comment opportunities on the draft regulations and follow the procedures outlined in statute and kind of overseen by the Office of Administrative Law. So 2016 is really that formal rulemaking process, and you'll notice in the long gray bar it says up to a year. Once the commission adopts draft regulations and we start the formal rulemaking process, it starts a one-year clock. So the commission must adopt and submit its final regulations within a year, or we start the clock over. So it's really important that we get out there, get public comment on the regulations, and make sure they get finalized within a year or sooner. The one requirement for the formal rulemaking process is once you've submitted your notice of proposed rulemaking, you hold a 45-day minimum public comment period. So in early 2016 will be our 45-day public comment period where we'll be doing another public meeting series. In 2017, I will point out the two stars at the end of 2016 is the adoption of the final regulations package, which then allows the commission to start our proposal solicitation process or application solicitation process. So we imagine in 2017 we'll be doing some early outreach, getting some pre-application information in, allowing applicants 3 to 6 months to develop their applications and then have applications submitted somewhere in the fall of 2017. Since we don't know how long the formal rulemaking process is going to take, we're assuming right now it'll take the full year, but we can always move the schedule up if we get to final regulations sooner. So to apply for Water Storage Investment Program funding, you've got to meet some basic eligibility requirements. You have to be an eligible applicant. You have to come forth with an eligible storage project. You have to have your feasibility studies complete and determine that the project is feasible. There are certain cost share requirements that I'll go through in a couple slides. And the project has to have a CEQA environmental document out for public review. So eligible applicants, these are defined in Chapter 4 of Proposition 1. Eligible applicants are public agencies, nonprofit organizations, public utilities, federally recognized Indian tribes, state Indian tribes, and mutual water companies. A question that we get at other public meetings that we do, is the federal government a eligible applicant? And the answer is no. The public agency side of statute was subdivisions of the state of California. So the federal government cannot be an eligible applicant. So the cost share formula for Proposition 1 can get a little complicated, but fundamentally, the commission cannot fund more than 50% of a total project cost. So our funding level will be based on the public benefits provided. Another check for the commission, based on statute, is that ecosystem benefits have to count for 50% of the public benefits funded. So the pie chart on the right kind of breaks down those requirements visually. So on the right-hand side in the yellow, we've got the funded public benefits capped at 50%. On the white side, it's the non-public benefit cost share partners, and they've got their 50% share. And so the commission is not fully funding any of these projects. There's always a cost share partner. And that white side is made up mostly of the beneficiaries of the non-public benefits. So if you look at the breakdown on the yellow side, the maximum of other public benefits is 50% because 50% of the public benefits have to be ecosystem. So if you come in with a project that has 30% ecosystem benefits, you cap, or let's say you've got 15% ecosystem benefits, you cap your other project public benefits at 15%, so we can only do 30% cost share. So what's driving that cost share number is the amount of ecosystem benefit provided. I think the easiest way to break that down is you can pay more ecosystem benefits, so it could be 50% non-public benefits and 50% ecosystem benefits as well. So the major components of applications, the applicant has to justify that they are indeed an eligible applicant. They have to provide a statement of no impact to federally and state designated wild and scenic rivers. They have to have their public draft of a CEQA document. Most likely that'll be your EIR, your environmental impact report, which would include a detailed project description and a detailed project impact analysis, so your environmental impact analysis. It also has to include documentation of your feasibility studies. Feasibility studies have to be complete. They also have to be documented in your application. In your documentation, the commission will want to see a description and quantification of your public benefits, including all support, modeling, if it was your economic analysis, all support for your documentation and your findings, a cost estimate and your cost allocation. And your cost allocation and cost shares have to be broken down within the requirements that we just discussed. And all your technical, environmental, economic, and financial feasibility study information. So getting into the application review process, this is another handout in your packet. It is the flowchart. So if you want to look at that, because it is a little difficult to see up here. It describes how your application will move through the commission's process. Once the commission adopts final regulations, we'll open up what's called our pre-application period. And we're going to do a pre-application where potential applicants can submit some preliminary information about their project. Project description, some qualitative information about the magnitude of public benefits provided, early information about costs and analysis that they've done. And really the point of this pre-application process is probably threefold. One, it provides an early opportunity for the commission to see the projects that might come in, and we can determine what resources we're going to need for the full evaluation of the applications. Two, it allows the public, other project proponents, and stakeholders to see the projects and get some early thought and information into the process. A good thing about having project proponents see the other projects that are out there, if they notice another project in their area, there's opportunities for integration. So if there's a region that has four projects and they're competing for the same water, competing for the same beneficiaries, it identifies an opportunity for these project proponents to get together and maybe do an integrated project. It also allows the commission staff to get an early look at the applications and help project proponents identify any fatal flaws. So if someone comes in with a project that maybe doesn't have an eligible applicant or is not an eligible project type, we can let that project proponent know sooner so they don't go through the additional expense of doing all the studies and completing a full application. So we will have staff review and do an initial fatal flaw review, I guess we'll call that. So after the pre-application, there's 3 to 6 months. We're assuming 6 months at this point for project proponents to do their completed full application. Then when the commission receives the full application, staff will do a completeness and eligibility review, and then a full technical review. And the team that is looking at these applications will be Water Commission staff, staff from the Department of Water Resources, staff from Fish and Wildlife, and staff from the State Water Board. Once the agency team, as we call it, finishes their completeness, eligibility, and technical reviews, the findings and evaluation done by the agency team will go to an independent review panel. So we'll have the independent review panel will be free of conflicts or bias on any of the projects, and we'll be able to evaluate the technical review done by the agency team. Once they've done their independent peer review, we'll have an opportunity for public and applicant input. So the commission will receive the findings from the technical review team and the independent reviewers. And once the commission receives them, because they are an organization that's bound by Bagley-Keene, anytime they receive anything, the public receives it at the same time. So the public will have an opportunity, applicants will have an opportunity to provide some additional information about the projects. After the input period and the commission has time to look at all the projects and make their decisions, they'll make their findings and make what we're calling an initial soft commitment. So the soft commitment will identify a cost share maximum that the commission will provide to a project based on the evaluation criteria that the commission have developed and weighed. And once they've once a project receives a soft commitment, they'll start doing what we call post-soft commitment activities. And those are things like getting all the project approvals, finishing your CEQA document, getting all your permits. So a lot of questions that we receive from project proponents are, oh my gosh, by 2017, do I have to have a final CEQA document? Do I have to have my final permits? Do I have to have my final approvals? No, the commission can evaluate your project based on draft CEQA document, your feasibility study documentation, and permitting and approvals, and all those things that can take time, a lot of time, can wait until after the soft commitment. I'm going to quickly go over the quantification of public benefits. So just briefly, what is a benefit provided by a storage project? It's a product or service for which people are willing to pay. It's a benefit to someone, and they're willing to pay for something for that. It's normally measured in physical units. It could be something like number of species, percent survival, water flow, water temperature, water volume. But we want to measure it as a physical change, and that's a comparison of your with project and without project conditions. Normally, you want to use a common unit of measure for your benefits, and you want to calculate your benefits over the entire project life. The common unit of measure that we're recommending the commission use for the Water Storage Investment Program is dollars. It's the easiest unit to use when you're comparing ecosystem improvements versus water quality improvements versus recreation improvements versus flood control benefits. So we're asking that people, to the maximum extent possible, monetize their benefits. It allows for a direct comparison. It allows for checks for staff when they're doing the 50% ecosystem benefits funded. It allows for a more direct ranking, and using dollars instead of other physical units allows you to take into account the value of timing, location, of water, because water this time of year in a drought is more valuable than water in the winter when it's raining a lot. So using monetized benefits allows you to account for that. So this is our typical framework for quantifying benefits and doing your cost allocation. The first two steps are defining and assessing your future with and without project conditions. The next step is comparing those physical physical benefits and impacts of those projects, so the difference between your with project condition and without project condition. And then you want to estimate the value of those physical benefits. You want to compare the present value of benefits and costs and allocate those costs to your beneficiaries. One of the things staff is working on right now is developing common assumptions, so some technical assistance to provide to project proponents. And these common assumptions allow the commission to make sure projects come in and they're looking at an equal playing field, that we can do as close to an apples-to-apples comparison as we can. We know there's a wide variety of projects out there. There's a wide variety of sizes of projects out there, and there's a wide regional distribution of projects. So we want to assign some common assumptions to different physical units and economic units, so everyone's using some of the same values. So 1 through 3, we're developing common assumptions on physical, and those can be hydrology, water operations, water quality, hydrodynamics, environmental conditions, and those common assumptions will really come into play in those first three steps. Steps 4, 5, and 6, we're developing some economic common assumptions, and those can include things like discount rate and dollar year of analysis. You know, just at the very basic, when we're comparing costs and benefits across multiple projects, it makes sense for all projects to use the same year of analysis. And right now we're looking at 2015. So I will open it up for about 15 minutes of questions.
I wonder, Mr.
Quintero, do you want to introduce yourself and give some, before we have comments, so you know that there's a commissioner here listening to you.
I really apologize for my tardiness. I came from Marin County, and there were three accidents, and it took 2 hours instead of one. Thanks so much for being here this evening. It's so important that you're engaging with the staff that's doing a lot of really great work in getting this program ready so that we're both on time and your time is not wasted in putting together proposals that will meet the criteria for the Prop 84 grants that are being administered by the State Water Commission or the California Water Commission. The commissioners are really looking forward to working with all of the projects, and we're particularly excited about, you know, the talent in the DWR staff and the focus that's being put on being able to work with proponents to get proposals to work effectively for you and for the state. And as Jenny was saying, you know, when you start looking at the whole state, if you're looking at a project at the south end of the San Joaquin Valley, it's very different than a project that's just north of the just north of the Delta. And so it's going to be, I think, one of our biggest challenges is to see how we can look at the projects that are being submitted and how we can really assess what can really benefit the state in terms of our water supply and moving forward. And right now, as we are in our fourth year of drought, it's my personal interest that what we do as a state and as water professionals is that we're really learning from this and that we really start applying solutions that will carry us through future times like this, because this is going to happen again at some point. And so we really have to put our heads together and be good cooperators with you in securing California's water supply going forward. So thanks so much for being here. And I'll be here for the rest of the evening. Thanks, Jenny.
So questions about what's allowed, what the program will do, what the timelines are, any of the things that Jenny suggested or briefed. Any questions or comments? I'll come back this way first.
Sure, thank you. You mentioned that the 50% cost share match was in all cases, but it looks like the statute has a different provision for conjunctive use and reservoir management.
There is an exception for conjunctive use and reservoir reoperation projects. The commission can exceed the 50% cap. They haven't made a decision if they are going to go over the 50% cap. The projects that are within statute eligible for a higher than 50% cost share are conjunctive use projects, so managing surface water and groundwater conjunctively together, and reservoir reoperation projects. Yes, so making operational changes to existing reservoirs.
Did you have another question? Or is that good? Okay, we'll come up with that. Right. Let me go back to this gentleman, and then I'll go this way.
Sure. And another statutory question, I guess. The salinity repulsion that's talked about, would that natural disaster, has the commission determined that what the range of natural disasters such as drought would be included in that?
So for the emergency response public benefit category, the commission has tentatively approved a definition that requires an emergency declaration. So if it's a situation like we're in now and there's a declared drought, then yes, that would count as a public benefit under this program.
Okay, let me go this way in this row. Any other questions or comments on this part? Yes, ma'am.
Could you repeat the definition of tributaries to the Delta that you cited?
Oh, yeah, of course. We've defined tributaries of the Delta to be the Sacramento River Hydrologic Region, the San Joaquin River Hydrologic Region, the Delta, of course, and the Susan Marsh.
Anybody over on this side? Raj has the microphone. Yes, sir, in the green shirt, and then I'll come to you, sir.
I have a couple questions, and I'm not sure you have answers to these yet, but I'll give it a shot. So the first one has to do with projects. And would you anticipate dividing projects into different categories that would be evaluated separately, category by category? For example, groundwater storage versus surface water storage projects, and that those two categories would not be, you would never compare a groundwater storage project to a surface water storage project?
We have talked about that with the commission. I think the commission wants to hold off making any decisions as to how to divvy up funding until they see the project applications in hand, or until they have the project applications in hand, because there's no basis right now for divvying up the funds. So I think it's something that they could consider, and they've talked about, but at this point, there's no plan to divvy up the funds based on project type. The statute requires the commission at least to have a competitive process, so compare project to project, so they've got to consider that when determining how to allocate funds. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I'd like to just make a comment. One of the things that the commission is very interested in is seeing projects starting to look at their neighbor projects and seeing if there's a way of combining them. So when you talk about surface water and groundwater, we already know plenty of opportunities in the state where there's the possibility of basically creating a conjunctive use agreement between, you know, a groundwater area where there's recharge and an upstream, either an upstream surface storage or even something like a flood control project that could be modified to direct water to groundwater in ways that we're not doing it right now. So there's something that we're holding out in terms of the commission is looking forward to some of the creative partnerships that could actually help sort of manage with your neighbors how you're managing regional water supplies. So that's an interesting question.
And I do have one more, but I have a follow-up to what you just said before I get to my second question.
Then I'll move on to somebody else, okay?
Okay.
Great.
Would the commission begin to focus on that particular issue that we've been talking about after you've seen some of the pre-applications?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're going to be working with staff to really start to figure out how we don't know what this is going to look like right now. And so, yes, we're very interested in starting to sort these into piles where we can have discussions that make sense for the group of applicants in a category.
And then my second question is really similar, and it just has to do with basically the same question except for projects in different geographic areas.
I think it's probably the same answer. The statute didn't provide any guidance or direction on distributing funds on a project level or on a regional level. So, it basically at its core, it was rank projects based on magnitude of public benefits. And of course, the commission will weigh a lot of other criteria in its decision. But as far as regional or project dispersal, I think it's hard to say now until the projects, we know what the world we're operating in. We did do a scoping survey earlier this year. We got about 170 responses, so we've got some early indication that there's a lot of interest in the projects or in the funding, and I think the projects totaled about $40 billion. So the 2.7 is a small drop in the need that's out there. And it's hard to judge at a scoping survey level how serious the potential project proponents are. So we didn't want to make any early decisions based on such preliminary information.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I've got a couple questions, and you just reminded me of one that I wanted to ask. I saw a PowerPoint presentation that was put together that kind of summarized at a very, very high level the information that you collected relative to those projects. Is there any intention to make the more detailed level information available? Who applied, what projects, etc.?
That's on the commission website. I don't have the exact location of it on the commission website, but if you want to leave your name and email, I can send you the information.
Okay.
It's available.
Cool. The other question I had is you talked a lot about the public benefit and the how the public benefit would be calculated, and you'd use a standard common measure. Has the commission thought about how private benefit would be measured and how that might include into project viability and ultimate project cost sharing?
Well, the private side or non-public benefit beneficiaries have to be cost share partners. At a minimum, they have to come up with the 50% cost share of the project. One of the criteria, I should have brought copies of it, is a consideration of improvements to water supply reliability, improvements to water management through the Delta. So there are considerations of the more or less private benefits associated with projects, but the primary focus of the commission is the public side.
Okay.
I just wanted to respond to your first question. The document is online right now. It's a little bit hidden under a meeting agenda, but right now we're in the process of updating our documents library. And so if you go to the website, there's a tab on the top. It says water bond. If you hover over it, it will show a link for documents library. And so it's not there yet, but we will add it to the documents library.
And there's cards on the back table with 6 or 7 different useful links. So bring those with you when you leave, because they'll be where to go find things that are in that card. So two more questions. Let me go here first.
Specifically on your timeline, it says the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. Who's on that committee?
There is, Juliana, you can correct me, 34 agencies that are part of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee representing potential project proponents, so the CalFed project sponsors, their CEQA leads, tribes, environmental NGOs, ag interests. Juliana, you can probably round out my list.
They're municipal, there's sort of, we kind of went city, state, and we went first Native American tribes, and then
I can get you a list of the
groundwater agencies, surface water agencies. So we kind of looked through the what was in the legislation and said, who needs to represent that point of view, and made sure there was somebody to represent each one of those points of views.
Yes. If you want to leave a name, I can get to you.
34, 35. Yeah. Is it 35 now? Yeah. Let's see. There's somebody over here. Okay, you were next, so let me go back that way and then come back. That's right, thanks. And then we'll, thanks, Raj, and then we'll go to the next presentation.
Thank you. Is there a maximum funding amount? I mean, will there be a limit on the amount funded?
The commission has not set a limit, a per-project limit, besides the 50% total project cost cap. This is probably one of those other decisions that's waiting to see what the world of projects is.
And kind of another related question, are these grants or loans?
They're grants.
Grants, very good.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there a definition of tributary?
The definition of tributary.
Yes, so any of the smaller branches of river off of the Sacramento, after off of the San Joaquin, if you're familiar with the water plan, we're using the water plan's definition of the Sacramento River Hydrologic Region and the San Joaquin River Hydrologic Region. So those include any of the watersheds that feed into the main stems of the Sacramento and the San Joaquin. I don't know if that's very clear, but.
Okay. There's two more. So this gentleman here and then you, ma'am. Yes.
I just want to recommend for the next meeting up in Chico or Redding, next time we had 200 people the last meeting, that was a good turnout. And the tributaries question, I want to applaud the commission for not adding the Tulare Basin to the tributaries, and I just had a quick question, why was Trinity Basin not added?
We wanted to focus on kind of the natural hydrologic regions, and the Trinity is connected by Central Valley Project facilities that I believe, I'm not an operator of Trinity, but I believe are mostly operated for agricultural purposes, and so it's not a connection that's there all the time. I mean, it is engineered. It's an engineered connection, but we want it to focus on kind of natural connections.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. I believe in the bill that we passed last November that the site's reservoir was specifically mentioned. And I'd like to know, is that among those things that have been proposed? Is somebody backing that in the proposals that you have thus far?
Site's reservoir would be included in the surface storage projects under the CalFed ROD. So it wasn't mentioned by name, but it's included in that group of projects. So that Site's reservoir, Temperance Flat, Los Vaqueros, and I am forgetting one, in Delta Storage. Thanks. So it's not mentioned by name, but it is an eligible project. And local sponsor, the Site's JPA, did respond to the scoping survey. So there is a local sponsor that is interested in pursuing that project.
Thank you.
Great. So I know that there's a number of other questions, but let's move on to the questions about ecosystem and water quality priorities. So first we'll hear from Scott Cantrell from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and talk about how they're going to measure the ecosystem benefits for the public benefit side. And then after Mr. Cantrell's done, we'll have some more questions on that piece, and then we'll hear from Gail Link on water quality benefits from the Water Resource Board, and then we'll have some more questions, and then general.
If it's okay, I think I'm going to sit. So welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Cantrell. I'm the chief of our water branch in the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we've been working closely with Water Commission staff and DWR, State Water Board, Delta Stewardship Council staff since about February of this year, where we really started up our efforts again just after the bond passed in November. And my department, me personally, in fact, we've been involved in all of the stakeholder advisory committee meetings. We've made presentations to the Water Commission on several occasions, and we're conducting outreach to NOAA Fisheries and Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that we have close alignment with our ecosystem priorities with them and their recovery plans and their endangered species that are listed and so on. So you'll see in a moment that that's one of our highest priority are species that are endangered or threatened or considered to be at risk. So this first slide, Jenny covered a lot of this already. This is language right out of Prop 1, and this describes what our job is in the first bullet there, which is to provide the priorities and relative environmental value of ecosystem benefits. And the Water Board has a similar charge, which is to provide the priorities and relative environmental value of water quality benefits, and that these must be included in the regulations. So we've grouped our priorities into six bins or categories, and I'm going to go through each of these in detail. And I would characterize our priorities right now as draft. We are currently updating this list of priorities. We're making them more concise and condensing them. So next week at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting, we will have an updated set of priorities, which we will distribute. And at the same time, it will be posted on the Water Commission website so you can look at the updated priorities. And, you know, they're generally the same. The content is the same, but we've just basically reorganized them to make a little more sense and also to reduce some of the redundancy. So I'm going to go through each of these in detail. There's six bins. So the first priority is to promote the recovery of endangered threatened species, as I said, working closely with the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries to identify those species that are in the Delta and the Delta tributaries. And we have a number of specific priorities. You might think of them as sub-priorities under this general category in this bin. The first one is to provide cold water at the right place and time to improve the survival of eggs and fry of salmon and steelhead. We know that cold water is very critical to their survival. The next priority is to provide flows at the appropriate time and location to ensure that there's adequate dissolved oxygen in the reds, which are the nests of salmon in the rivers. Dissolved oxygen in those and flow of water through those reds is the mechanism by which oxygenation is ensured. The next category is to provide flows to reduce juvenile stranding of salmon and steelhead. That can typically happen when there's dramatic flow fluctuations during reservoir operations. The next priority is to operate facilities to avoid stranding of immigrating adult salmon and sturgeons in the floodways and bypasses. And again, this is largely through well-conceived operational plan to ensure that this doesn't happen. The next priority is to provide increased spring flows to improve conditions for juvenile and smolt rearing and out-migration. We know that the success of juvenile and smolts making it out to the ocean dramatically improves the return to the natal rivers 3 years later. So it's important to improve the survival of that early life stage of salmon and steelhead. The next priority is to provide summer flows to improve conditions for in-river rearing. And this is particularly important for steelhead salmon. The next priority is to provide attraction flows at the appropriate time and location to benefit nadromous species during their upstream migration to improve passage and reduce straying. And this is the concept of providing the right scent of water for adult salmonids as they're migrating upstream to their natal streams to spawn. If that scent isn't there, they can stray into places that they shouldn't go, and they get confused, particularly like in the Delta when they don't have a clear scent of Sacramento River water, for example, or San Joaquin River water. The next priority is to increase Delta outflow in spring, summer, or fall for pelagic fishes in the Delta, and this is focused on Delta smelt and longfin smelt. And there's actually a typo there. To increase survival of immigrating juvenile salmonids, that shouldn't be there. It's this priority is focused on outflow for pelagic fishes. The next priority is to restore and enhance seasonal patterns of flow and temperature to benefit green sturgeon and white sturgeon, and also providing increased outflow to improve juvenile recruitment. So this is what that one's about. It's focused on green and white sturgeon. And then next we have sort of an operational priority, which is to achieve all these priorities, we feel that it's important to operate these facilities, storage and surface and groundwater storage facilities in an operated and integrated manner, and use the operational flexibility that can be accrued through conjunctive use and integration of projects into the state water management system and water exchanges and water transfers. There's a lot that can be done through a system view of operations, and so we've articulated that as a priority.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so number two, this one is this category of priorities, or this bin, pertains to ecological processes, physical processes, flow regimes to activate floodplains, to increase primary and secondary productivity, maintain channel form and function, and so on. And so that's what the first priority is saying, is provide the pulse flows to activate these geomorphological processes and transport functions. And then as a benefit of that, the second priority in this list is to enhance habitat complexity and quality, including the run, riffle, and pool complexes. And this is the idea of having in-channel structure and escape cover, hiding places for young salmon. And the next priority is to restore historic salmonid habitat in channels and sloughs, including rewatering of channels. And this is getting at increasing the distribution and abundance and habitat for spawning anadromous fishes. Next, number 2D is to increase the frequency, magnitude, and duration of floodplain inundation to achieve multi-benefit objectives of wetland habitat, productivity, juvenile fish rearing, and also to provide alternative migration corridors. I'm sure many of you are aware of some of the fish planning and evaluation that's going on right in our backyard here in the Yellow Bypass. There's tremendous benefits to be accrued through more frequent floodplain inundation. That is really a limiting factor for a lot of these fishes because of the way that we've modified our river systems for flood risk reduction, land reclamation, and so on. The next priority is to provide groundwater recharge and thereby improving sediment quality and environmental water quality. And there's a lot of co-benefits that can be achieved through groundwater storage projects such as seasonal wetlands in spreading basins over aquifers, seasonal and permanent wetlands, and so on, to benefit a whole variety of aquatic and terrestrial species. And the next priority is to restore access to anadromous fish by improving fish passage, and I've talked about that one before. So 2G, next slide, is to enhance salmon habitat through the implementation of sediment management plans. And this is really, the objective here is to ensure that there's clean gravel and cobble at the appropriate location and in the right size distributions that are optimal for anadromous fishes to stir up and lay their eggs, create their reds. The next category is, or the next priority is restore riparian communities to increase shade and to reduce water temperatures for aquatic species and also to support terrestrial species. We know that riparian habitat is very critical to maintain biological diversity, and something like, oh, I've heard figures like 95% of riparian habitat in California has been eliminated. So it's really considered a rare natural community. It maintains a lot of species diversity, and so that's why it's on the list. The next priority is enhance habitat through removal or modification of infrastructure. And this is getting at problems where, for example, adult migrating fish encounter a weir of some sort that they just can't, they just physically can't make it over the top. So in some places, we have a pretty good experience in designing fish ladders, for example. So it's to ensure that we don't do anything to further impede the migration of fishes or to remediate existing problems. So the next category is number three, which is enhancing commercial and recreational opportunities. And this these priorities are related to increasing providing for reservoir-based recreation, both consumptive and non-consumptive uses, you know, categories that would normally be associated with water contact recreation, like fishing and boating and swimming, nature observation, and so on. The second priority is to increase populations of native commercial and recreational species. And then the last in this bin is to increase wildlife habitat on refuges and also to provide increased water supply. The next slide, number four, this one is related to reducing the negative effects of non-native invasive species on our target native species and natural communities. And the two priorities in this category are to develop and implement invasive species management plans, and secondly, to develop and implement water project operational plans that through operations can provide more favorable flow and temperature and turbidity and other biotic and abiotic conditions to favor the abundance and distribution of the native species that we're trying to promote the recovery of. So the next category is number five. This is to prevent or reduce negative impacts from in-river structures. And this, the priorities in this category are things like improving, putting fish screens on unscreened diversions or remediating a poorly screened diversion that entrains fish. It involves removing or remediating barriers to fish passage and constructing and operating facilities to reduce stranding and mortality of fishes. So there's both physical solutions and there's operational solutions that can be implemented to reduce stranding and mortality. Then the last bin of priorities, this one is related to managing aquatic and riparian habitat and managed and unmanaged wetlands. And the priorities in this category are to provide water to enhance wetlands and riparian habitat and also to enhance managed seasonal wetlands on wildlife refuges and also on other lands, both public and private, that are being managed for public ecosystem values. So the next slide is relative environmental values, and I'll go through this quickly. This is still a work in progress, but these are what we would consider the factors that would be very important when evaluating proposals. And this is also required in the regulation that we have to articulate what are the relative environmental values. And so we have 11 listed here. First one is pretty apparent. It's, you know, the number of priorities addressed. So the greater the number of priorities that a project is addressing, and the better. The second value is consistency with existing conservation and recovery plans. So this would be like a project that's going to include implementation of targets that are identified in the NOAA Fisheries Recovery Plan for Central Valley Salmonids. You know, that would be good. Water use efficiency, what we mean here is environmental water use efficiency, which is using water to achieve multiple ecosystem benefits. Number four is measurable rather than descriptive or qualitative type benefits. The more that we can be, you know, that we can assess these project outcomes in a quantitative manner through well-documented model outputs, the better. Proximity to existing resources. This is the idea of having the public benefit, the ecosystem benefits proximal, you know, close in space and time to the water storage project. And also proximity to areas that are already in some sort of, that are being managed for conservation values. The next category is the magnitude of measurable benefits, clear performance measures and metrics, the certainty of achieving these benefits through substantive evidence, such as model outputs, the immediacy of benefits in time, the duration and the long-lasting nature of these benefits, the permanence, and then finally, having projects that incorporate climate change adaptation and resilience as part of their project operational plan. So the next slide, the last slide is next steps. So we're currently refining the priorities and the relative environmental values, as I said, and we'll have those available mid-next week. And we're working with the commission staff and the consultant team to develop an approach to apply these priorities and relative values during the proposal evaluation phase of this process. And we're on track, as Jenny portrayed in the timeline, to have all this information ready for incorporation into the draft regulation and guidelines next month in August. So that concludes my presentation. Do you want to?
Great. So any questions on the ecosystem benefits? Raj, do you have a microphone? Okay, I'll go this way, and Raj will be on this side. So yes, ma'am. Let me make my way towards you.
Okay, both on the ecosystem priority slide, your items 1 through 6, and then also when you were going through the relative environmental values on those two numbered points slides, are those items on those slides already ranked?
The relative environmental values? Or the...
You mean is number one more important than number
no,
two?
No. These would all be equally considered. They would all be weighed. And that's what I was referring to. We're working with the consultant team and the commission staff to figure out exactly how we're going to apply these during the proposal review process. And the same goes for the ecosystem priorities. Number one isn't more important than number three. You know, they're all priorities.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions on the ecosystem priorities? All right. Raj, if you can get the gentleman here with glasses.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. The ecosystem priorities still draft.
Yes, they're still drafting.
So I want to be clear, I'm fully supportive of the priorities. I have one concern and sort of one question then. So one is really overarching concern that that the mitigation fund, despite the statutory requirements, gets used to facilitate either the biological opinions or the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. So that's sort of an overarching concern. Because there's many good things in those priorities, but those priorities can be used for project-level benefits.
I believe there's a prohibition in the bond language. This is you can't fund mitigation. Is that right?
That's correct. Mitigation, or more importantly, compliance obligations, which is the door open for those. But I think my question then is...
So that question was answered?
That wasn't a question, comment.
Oh, it was a comment. Okay, thank you.
And over, basically, it's a concern. But I think the conjunctive use impacts, which actually the statute tried to get to, which was to reduce the rate or reverse decline of shallow groundwater, particularly when it comes to fisheries, we have a problem with conjunctive use where the tributaries are impacted for the sake of water transfers. And because it's very difficult to actually measure that in the real world, there's a lot of sort of numerical shuffling for those activities. It concerns me that there's not a clear articulation of the statute back into the direction for this, that the net difference of groundwater should ultimately be increased, or the rate of reduction decreased. Does that make sense?
Thanks.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so did you have a question?
No, but I'll ask one.
You were nodding as if you were next.
I was agreed.
Oh, okay.
What about water transfers? How do they affect this sort of thing, and particularly in dry drought times?
I'm not sure that's directly relevant to my presentation.
Well, it might be if you're talking about conjunctive use.
Well, what I did state that operational flexibility can be greatly enhanced through a systems approach to reservoir operations, water exchanges, water transfers, and that sort of thing. I think water transfers will always be a tool available. I guess I'm not totally clear on what your question is. Okay.
Okay, so you had a question, ma'am?
Yes. Thank you. Question. I've been hearing a lot about levee setback and the idea that this allows more water to percolate down. I happen to have in a collection of mine pictures of Sacramento pretty well underwater, and of course that's why we have all those high steps there. And I wonder, where are the safety precautions? I see a lot of worry about salmon here, but I don't see worry about flooding because we are removing infrastructure and so on. So where are the concerns and the guidelines for measuring safety aspects of all this? And is any of this money going to be used to do the removal of levees? I mean, is this money all going to only to co-funded projects, or will this also be used for engineering to do levee setback? And will any of this money go to reimburse people whose homes are removed by eminent domain through this? I've already heard of 6 homes over in Sacramento along the river being purchased by eminent domain, and are those part of this funding?
That's a Jenny question.
I'm happy to answer that. So this funding is specific to the public benefits associated with storage projects. So the storage transit projects defined by statute.
There we go. So the storage projects defined by statute are surface and groundwater projects, and conjunctive use and system re-up. So levee setbacks are outside the scope of this program.
But what about safety issues that would be affected by the program?
So safety issues being in the design, such as, a dam is built, the safety issues associated with that, that would be considered in the feasibility study, and so we require that as part of the feasibility study documentation, people look at the, you know, engineering feasibility, the construction feasibility, so these would be built to today's standards. Does that?
I would like to see safety written somewhere on all this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
system questions, because we want to hear about water quality as well. Nope. Okay, so Gail? Yes.
Just a quick comment, sir. Your ecosystem priority number two, I think, is completely outside of the scope of storage. All A through however far in the alphabet you go on that. You're talking about rewatering channels and sloughs, removing flood infrastructure. I just cannot for life of me see how any of those points have to do with a storage component of a bond. They're all good points, but have nothing to do with storage.
Thanks.
Thank you for that comment.
Okay, Gail. All right, so we'll hear about water quality, and then we'll open it up to general comments and questions.
Good evening. Is this on? I just turned it off. Good evening, everyone. I'm Gail Link. I'm an environmental program manager with the State Water Resources Control Board. Tonight I'm going to try to do a brief overview of the Water Board's water quality priorities, so you have ample time to ask more questions at the end. As you know, the State Water Board was charged with providing these water quality priorities for the purposes of the program. We have developed a paper, 11-page paper, on the water quality priorities, and including some of the thinking behind it, what are some of the issues involved related to the priorities. And they are posted on the Commission's website, and with the updated document library, I think it will be easier to find very soon. I want to note that these water quality priorities are those that were identified as being associated with or potentially influenced by water storage projects. They do not represent all of the State Water Board's water quality priorities. And we also, in developing these priorities, recognize the importance of connections between water quality and quantity, and between water quality and ecosystem priorities that Scott just went through. So that was the intro, the title page. So what you're seeing up there now are, we've identified 8 water quality priorities. 1 through 5 concern impaired waters in the state. And so we are required to, under the Clean Water Act, to prepare lists of water bodies in the state that are surface water that are impaired for various reasons. We've identified 5 parameters that for which we have listed impaired water bodies, and that could be affected by a water storage project. There could be some features of that project which could address these impairments. And there are temperature, dissolved oxygen, nutrient, mercury, and salinity. And some of these things are related to each other in the environment. And so similar strategies of a project in design or operation could address more than one. Also, too, I would go through and say, as I go through these individually, how many impaired water bodies of the total for each parameter are downstream of a reservoir or in a reservoir. But I'm going to skip that just in the interest of time, but we do have that information also available on the Commission's website. So next slide. The 3 remaining priorities have to do with groundwater, delta flows, and development of local water supplies that would reduce delta demand. So, and I'll go through each of these 6 or 6, 8 priorities slide by slide following right now. So what we've done here is just provided that that statement of the priority, which for the five impaired water body priorities, it says, we say, improve the condition in the water body on the section 303D list. That's impaired water bodies list. And what that means for all five of the impaired water body priorities is to provide measurable improvements in that parameter, such as temperature in this case, and to reduce or eliminate the exceedances of water quality objectives for temperature downstream of reservoirs. And so each of these parameters, we have I have a slide like this, and we have some examples of some strategies that could be taken to address that impairment. And for temperature, design and operate the reservoirs so the manner of releasing water could result in achieving or at least improving that condition. Okay, the next one, same thing for dissolved oxygen, measurable improvements. And usually what improves temperature also improves DO. And the third priority on the next slide, nutrient conditions. Same thing, we want to improve conditions so that they're measurable. And our goal at the Water Board is to delist these impaired waters. We don't want them impaired anymore. So projects that can help achieve that would be desirable. Again, this here, these are just some examples on some strategies that could be taken to address nutrient levels. Okay, next slide is just some more nutrient strategies listed here. They're in the handout that you have, and they're described in more detail in the Water Board's paper that's posted on the Commission website. Number four, mercury, same thing. We have a problem with methyl mercury. Many of you probably know about that. So that is one of our priorities as well. And lots of different strategies that could be taken by a project to address. Okay, the next slide is just simply more strategies. There's a lot of things that can be done to help address mercury impairments. All right, the next slide on priority number five is improving the salinity conditions. And this is focusing somewhat because the focus of the program is on improvements in the delta, reducing or eliminating exceedances of salinity objectives for the delta or San Joaquin River, or it could be for any other water downstream of a reservoir. But as Jenny mentioned, the delta improvements to delta ecosystem and its tributaries is a requirement for the program. Several strategies, again, that could be taken to address those. The priority number six for water quality is to protect or clean up groundwater. We have decided to use the Department of Water Resources, CASGEM. It's California Statewide Groundwater Elevation Monitoring Program. They have various levels of priorities, high, medium, low, and very low, I think. We've decided to focus our priority on the high and medium priority basins. The high priority basins are 43 out of the 515. The medium are 84 of the 515 basins. And these high and medium priority basins account for 96% of the state's annual groundwater pumping and supply 88% of the population overlying the groundwater basin. So again, we have a list of some of the strategies that can be taken to address groundwater conditions in the state. And the next slide is simply more of those, and you can take a look at those. If you have any questions later, just feel free to ask me. Number seven is achieve deltatory tributary stream flows that resemble natural hydrograph patterns or another flow regime that is demonstrated to improve conditions for aquatic life. Again, you can see the connections to a lot of the ecosystem priorities that Scott went over. And so part of our work is to try to align these and integrate them in a way that will make sense for the evaluation criteria that will be used to look at the projects, project applicant, or proposed projects.
Again, there's some statement on the strategy that could be used for that. The State Water Board's Bay Delta Plan actually has water quality objectives for stream flow. And the last priority that we've listed for the Water Board is to reduce the current or future water demand on the Delta watershed by developing local water supplies. And we have various water quality programs at the Water Board, which could help to do that, including promoting the use of recycled water, increasing stormwater capture and reuse, promoting low-impact development, and then, of course, conjunctive use and other groundwater storage that could happen. So these water quality priorities are still draft as we go through the process. When Fish and Wildlife comes up with their new condensed, realigned, taking what you saw today and kind of reorganizing it a bit, then we'll take a look at our water quality priorities at the same time, making sure that they all make sense together, and the relative environmental values. We're currently looking at Fish and Wildlife's list that Scott went over, and then we'll come up with some kind of a statement of what the Water Board's view of the relative environmental value for as it pertains to water quality priorities would be. So that part is in process. Any questions?
Let me turn back to questions and comments for Gail, and then we'll talk a little bit about next steps and future engagement. So any questions about the water quality benefits? Yes, sir.
Your point number 8, reduce current and future water demand on the Delta watershed. Storage project can only occur within the Delta watershed. I don't see how point 8 can even be included in something that's discussing additional storage within the Delta watershed.
So I think to answer the question, there's no regional requirements for project locations. So projects could occur anywhere in the state as long as they can still satisfy statute, and that one requirement is measurable improvements in the Delta or Delta TRIBs. So there does need to be a direct or indirect connection to the Delta, but projects can be located outside of the Delta. Does that answer your question? Maybe I didn't understand it.
Outside the Delta watershed.
Yes. Well, outside the Delta proper.
So you would be saying that in case something down south would decrease the demand for water transfer, it could be seen as indirectly helping the Delta by reducing outflow. That's the only way I see it.
Increasing outflow, yeah.
I'm saying that if a project down south would locally help them have water so we didn't need to transfer so much down south, it would indirectly help the Delta because water wouldn't have to go from north to south.
Yeah, reducing exports and increasing outflow. Yeah.
All right, we're on the same page.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, anybody else? Yes, sir.
So it seemed to me several of the state priorities run in direct conflict with the compliance obligation. So D1641, salinity control in the Delta, that's an obligation by the projects. And by increasing water availability for outflow, for them to meet 1641 would be a private benefit using these funds. Do you agree?
The statute allows, in Chapter 8, that it says, and I can't quote it directly, but to the effect that funds cannot go to mitigation and compliance obligations except in the provision of public benefits. So water quality improvements would be considered
provision of public benefits.
So mitigation for the state and federal water projects to meet their compliance obligations would be considered public benefits?
I think we'd want to look at that on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I think I'm going to go with just a couple of comments on this one. And I'd say just in general, when I hear the priorities both from the ecosystem and from the water quality standpoint, and I think about groundwater projects, groundwater storage or conjunctive use, and especially local projects, I have a hard time seeing how those projects in those categories could score very well given the priorities as they're stated in draft at this time. And I want to cite an example. Your number five with the water quality is to improve salinity conditions in water bodies on California's 303D list. And you could basically take that priority and rewrite it for groundwater basins with groundwater quality that's brackish or saline. So the whole point here is that there may be quote-unquote impaired groundwater basins that are natural salt sinks that you could conceive of a project to alleviate that water quality problem, and it has nothing to do with groundwater levels per se. One other part to this comment, and this is really more for staff of the commission and the commissioners, and that is that I could also see some opportunities for this same kind of thing where we're talking about water quality improvements for projects that either one alleviate some kind of a salt sink water balance issue in a groundwater basin or that involve brackish groundwater desalination.
Yeah, and just to clarify that groundwater contamination prevention and remediation projects are eligible as long as there's a nexus to a storage component.
When you say improve salinity conditions, that lets it go either way. So are there any cases in which you're looking to add salt water to something?
I'm trying to think. Well, we have salinity criteria objectives for the delta, and it's tidally influenced, so I think that those objectives can sometimes you have too much fresh water, going outflow. Maybe too much isn't the right word, but it is variable, the salinity levels that go back and forth. But in a particular water, a freshwater system, like a surface stream, typically salinity is not a good thing. And as he pointed out, salinity, we do have salinity problems in our groundwater.
Right. I just, two things here are worded in such a way that when it says improve salinity conditions and to meet salinity objectives, either one of those could be looked at as we want it higher or we want it lower. And I just was wondering if there are some specific cases where you want it to be higher.
I can't think of any.
Okay. All right.
But,
thank you.
But you know, we would look at it, everything case by case. So, because the impairments on here for something like mercury, salinity, they are maximum amounts, concentration based. We don't want to go above those numbers. I can't think that we have a water quality objective for a minimum salinity concentration. Salt concentration. I'm not aware, with the exception of just the natural salt balance in the Delta estuary.
So I wonder, Jenny, if you want to give people some input on some future engagement opportunities, and then just have any chance for the rest of you if there's any lingering questions, comments, or notes that you want to give to the staff.
So I just want to outline a couple of next steps and opportunities for future engagement. So our near-term next steps, near-term for us, It's about through February timeframe of next year. We're currently drafting the content of the regulations language. That'll be presented to the commission over the next several commission meetings. So the commission meetings in September, October, and November will be all about the regulations language, with the intent of the commission being able to adopt the draft language at their November meeting. And as I said before, that starts the formal rulemaking process, and the formal rulemaking process will follow the Administrative Procedures Act. So we'll continue to define the application requirements and develop guidance for applicants. This is something the technical team is very busy working on right now. We plan on providing the draft regulations for early and informal content, so that'll be the September and October timeframes. So come to a commission meeting, come to a stakeholder advisory meeting. We're doing another round of public meetings in October. If you really enjoy what you saw here today, give us a note to come back, and we'd be happy to try to come back. Initiate the formal rulemaking process, so we'll initiate that in November, and that kicks off a 45-day public comment period. A big point of the Administrative Procedures Act, this formal rulemaking process, is to allow for meaningful public comment. So not only are we trying to do as much public outreach and get public comment ahead of the formal rulemaking process, but during the formal rulemaking process, we're required to provide opportunities for public comment. So once we initiate that formal rulemaking process, there's a minimum 45-day public comment period. We're also going to hold a public hearing and public meetings in early 2017. So I guess we can't stress this enough. Public and stakeholder participation is key. The commission is very earnest in wanting to hear feedback on any of its programs, but particularly the water storage investment program. It's set up to get as much public and stakeholder participation as possible. The commission meetings are every third Wednesday of the month. Every other meeting, we've been trying to travel to different locations. We're in Sacramento in the next meeting in September. This August meeting, we're going to be in Los Angeles. Public meetings, we've got another series in October. Our stakeholder advisory committee meeting meets the first Wednesday of every month. So this Wednesday, we are meeting at the Cal EPA building on August the 5th, so this coming Wednesday. It's a public meeting. There's opportunities for available meeting. We mostly coordinate with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, but there are opportunities for public comment. We also have the Commission's website and listserv. There's a handy card in the back with useful links. We suggest that you take one so you can continually check our website. We update it almost daily. And we plan to do another project scoping survey in early 2017, so keep your eye out if you're interested in applying for WISP funding and would like to put some early project information forth. We'll be doing another scoping survey early next year. So I'll open it up again for another round of questions, but thank you so much for coming and bearing with us for almost the whole time.
On the handout that is provided to us, it says hold public hearings in early 2016. Up there, you've got 17.
That might be a typo. I don't have the handout in front of me, but we've done some public meetings in early 2016. I'm sorry. That should be 2016. That slide should be 2016. Yeah. The handout's correct. I am wrong.
Yeah.
No, my mind was thinking that this year is 2016 and 2017 is next year. No, next year we will be doing public hearings.
Yes, ma'am.
When do you anticipate that this whole process will be finished, completed, and that funding will be made available for the projects that have been approved?
So we're anticipating at this point that The projects will submit proposals in of the fall of 2017. That date completely hinges on the formal rulemaking process and what happens next year. It's difficult at this point for staff to speculate on how long the formal rulemaking process will take. It could take a minimum of 3 months. I think we had a AOL person tell us that it generally takes about 6 months, but it can take up to a year. And
are you anticipating then these projects probably won't start within the next 5 years?
I think there's projects that will start sooner. Some of the larger projects are probably looking at the 5 year plus time frame.
Any other comments or questions? Nope. Let me turn.
You know, I wanted to comment on your question about how can you be increasing flows when you're storing the water. Can you hear me now? Is that better? Sorry. The gentleman had a question about how can you be increasing flows to the Delta if you're storing that water. And I think the way we think about it is that we tend to try to store water when we've got high flows. And what we really want to do is maintain the natural hydrographic sort of behavior of the Delta. So think of it in terms of keeping water or retaining water in the storage systems at different times of the year, but when we need it in the Delta, we'll be able to provide it to keep the Delta somewhat in better balance than it is now.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Make sure you take some a card at the back of the room as you leave and keep engaged. Thank you very much.